You know, there's a movie, I don't know, about 10 years ago, The Aviator, which is, you know, relatively close. I mean, I read the book it was based on, and it was actually, you know, a little bit hyped up here and there. A lot of it was very, very real. And, you know, he almost died test flying before the end of World War II. Whose aircraft built a prototype of a new plane for the military, and Howard Hughes almost died when it crashed. And, I mean, there was no reason why he had to fly it. He just really felt it was his baby and he was going to fly it. No prototype.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a story about that. Apparently, after he was scooped up, after the plane fell out of the sky, he was not happy with the design of his hospital bed, so he designed the new one.
Actually, you know what really impressed me about that book, about how it was, what the movie was based on, that really blew me away, although I must admit it has nothing to do with aviation or anything like that.
Okay.
Howard Hughes' mother had this germ obsession, and Howard Hughes picked up the germ obsession, and towards the end of his life, it became an overriding obsession. And he actually died of it. Howard Hughes died of something that you or I wouldn't die of, because his obsession with germs actually blew up in a counterproductive way, and he died of a bacterial infection, because the thing became so insane it became unworkable. But here's the point. When he was about 12, 13 years old, his mother sent him one summer to a summer camp. And, you know, this was in the early days of summer camps, and there was one that was very, you know, rugged, Indian, American Indian motif. And apparently he was having a wonderful time as a camp director, was corresponding with his mother. Remember, they were a very wealthy family. And then he's having a wonderful time, but she insisted, no, there are too many germs out in the woods. She wants them back in the city. I don't think I have to tell you, Roy, she had that completely backed. But the one time in his life that Howard Hughes was really having a good time without all of his mission goss upon mission goss was when he was in that summer camp run by a fellow named Daniel Carter Ear. The reason it blew me away, a couple of years later, a guy named William Boyce discovered that there was a new organization called the Boy Scouts in England, and he thought it would be a nice idea to start it in the United States. And he said, I don't know anything about running a summer camp. So he looked around, and you know who we got to help him start the Boy Scouts? Daniel Carter Pierce. And another one, William Good Howard C. But the bottom line is, basically, the only time in his life Howard Hughes was happy was at a Boy Scout camp. I spend a lot of time at Boy Scout camps even today.
Well, it's nice to know he had some good days. I think his actual cause of death listed on his death certificate was kidney failure. I'm not quite sure from what, but he had a lot of problems. Apparently, he also suffered from neurosyphilis, which you might have caused some of the neurological situations that he demonstrated in his life. So, again, very complicated guy. Very unfortunate. It's very depressing. You know, when you hear about guys who accomplish such great things, unfortunately, time was the thing that destroyed them. And, you know, he was a mere shadow of his former self in that hotel room. You know, you want your heroes and the giants of technology to kind of go out with a bang, not quite with that kind of a whimper.
Well, Richard Feynman did.
Yes, indeed. Richard Feynman Again, probably if I knew more about him, I'd buy something that wasn't perfect, that no one's perfect. I think there are already people mumbling and saying that he was a womanizer, and you know that he didn't have the 21st century's attitude to treating women or some such things. But yeah, him and his bongos, I loved him, and he had that great accent. You know, whereas other people kind of got rid of their accents as quickly as possible, you knew that Richard Feynman came from Far Rockaway.
Oh, I know quite a bit about him. I've read a fair amount about him. But what was interesting was, yeah, he also was on the Manhattan Project in World War II. But Richard Feynman was home. He was retired. He had cancer. He was dying. One day he gets a call. They want him to participate on the investigation of the Challenger space shuttle accident. He said, you know I'm dying, don't you? And they said, yeah, we know. Wouldn't that be a nice way to go out? And it turns out exactly how it played out, O-ring and all.
Yeah, I remember the O-ring incident. I remember him demonstrating it. He was a prankster at the Manhattan Project. He used to break into safes as a hobby, and you know he would throw little pranks and such, and annoy the older people because he was, I think, a graduate student at the time.
Yeah, I read about that. He wasn't that brilliant. Want to hear a secret?
Okay.
This was the early days of combination locks to a safe. And everybody needed three numbers. And they all basically took their birthday. All they had to do was to find out their birthdays and they could open their lock.
Okay, but, you know, in his own way, it was a clever thing to do. You know, I mean, there's ways around everything, but most of us don't bother to figure it out. I don't know. I always found him a fascinating guy. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've seen Feynman diagrams. They give me nosebleeds. You know, they're the basis of quantum field theory and such. There are papers, his lecture notes from the 60s. He gave a series of lectures that were so complicated that undergraduates didn't show up. The rest of the physics department showed up to listen to him present topics for discussion. And, you know, you can buy them bound. You could download them on the Internet. I think they're not copyrighted or such. Brilliant man. Deeply lost. There are clever physicists today, thankfully, but you know, he was a particularly interesting character in my mind.
Can you find this story? You might like this.
Sure.
Apparently, at some point in time, bought, you know, little paddle trucks in England. And he went to great effort to paint Feynman diagrams on it. And he drove it around, and finally he got a fight. Somebody recognized him and said to him, why do you have Feynman diagrams painted on your truck? Looked him in the eye and said, shrugged his shoulders, because I'm Feynman. Laughed hysterically and drives off.
That's a great story. I like that. I kind of been interested to know what percentage of the American public would recognize a Feynman diagram. I would place it significantly below 1%, but still, that's a great story.
It took a couple of years before he found the woolly sucker.
Yeah, well, if you drove around MIT or Stanford or someplace like that, you probably have a much higher hit rate. But, yeah, it's a little on the esoteric side.
Oh, a personal story of a similar genre.
Okay.
when my son was a toddler, we lived a couple of blocks from the shopping center, and I would often take him for a walk. It was a slow process. We'd stop to smell the flowers and stuff like that. Anyway, we're walking along, and we see this woman wearing, I noticed this woman wearing an interesting t-shirt. And it says, "And God said," and then there's Maxwell's equation, and then there was light. Now I figure, I'm walking with a toddler. I mean, so I figure she's not going to be hitting on her. And I said, "Excuse me, I'm fascinated by that shirt. Where did you get it?" She said, "Oh, in the gift shop in the Hayden Planetarium, but I have no idea what it means, but I just thought it was too." So I said, "Well, let me summarize it. Those are Maxwell's equations that predicted that light could travel through a vacuum, which was a big question. Sound has to travel through air, but light can travel through a vacuum, and Maxwell's equations, which is on your shirt, is what proved it, so now it makes sense." So she said, "Thank you," and we went a separate way.
Okay, very good. I think I have that shirt. I definitely have something with the equations on it. I don't remember if I picked the one that said God, God made the pain, isn't it? Let there be light. It doesn't, Maxwell's theory really does, didn't prove that light travels in vacuum. Because the guys that built the interferometers were still busy building interferometers in order to demonstrate that luminiferous ether actually existed. So, you know, they were pushing the idea of ether at the turn of the century still, even with Maxwell's beautiful equation.
Old habits die hard. Although I have to disagree, I don't believe that saying the name of the Lord is vain. I think whatever designed the universe was proud of that stuff, and that's honoring, not taking the vain.
Oh, well, I don't know. I would probably have to ask three rabbis and take a majority reading. Who knows? I don't know. Old habits die hard with me. You know, this is just stuff I learned as a little child. It's in the firmware that I was practically born with.
Been there, done that. But that's my point. I think you have to take this.
Well, hopefully you've noticed I tend to take a lot of things with a grain of salt these days. Age hopefully brings wisdom. At least that's what I keep telling myself. Certainly, but could you kind of maneuver the antenna a little bit, because you're fading into the noise, unfortunately.
Is it better if I hold it vertical?
Much better.
I have come to believe something. Now, this is just my opinion. You're entitled to disagree with me all you want. Now, you know the Christian faith is big on St. Peter. I say, let's take the St. Peter model. The idea is, after you die, the soul goes for an interview. And St. Peter is the usual interviewer according to Christian theology. But I believe all religions share that in some form or another. And I think, to use the model, St. Peter asks you two questions. Who did you help that you didn't have to? And who did you hurt that you didn't have to? And people say, but, he says, no, those are the only two that count. That's my take.
Okay, not that religion is at all a good topic for anything on the radio. Judaism kind of never really had a hell, historically, and heaven was kind of very vague and not really specified. Ultimately, if you wander through the text, the concept, I think, amounts to if God finds you a righteous soul, Then when the Messiah comes, he will equip you with a new body, sometimes with wings, because apparently there's going to be water covering the earth, and you all fly flat back to Israel or something. But the people who are not considered righteous are just left to decay, you know, in their graves and such. So Judaism tends not to have much of a heaven or much of a hell. It has a kind of earthbound afterlife, from my understanding, after a Messiah lands, but otherwise, not much. The duality of religion really took over after Judaism handed it off to Christianity and Islam. Islam is another kind of dualistic religion. That's kind of because of the Persians. The Persians were really deeply into yin-yang, into good, bad, into a good and evil God, all kinds of stuff. So he kind of, and Iran, Persia, was kind of the big country that ran everything at that point. So religion kind of did that little shift into black and white.
Oh, yeah, there's a long, long, convoluted history with millions of switches around.
Yes, indeed. Again, you always have to be careful about discussions of religion. I remember once actually telling someone in a shul that I was deeply interested in all the different religions, and thankfully he did not kill me. He looked like he might, but he didn't.
I suspect you would have had the same reaction with any one of a long list of topics in this religion.
Yes, most likely. One of the most religious easygoing about religion was a patient I had who was a nun. She was a sweet lady. She would talk other religions. She didn't put anything down or anyone down. I had other patients who every single visit wanted to convert me. And, you know, I would, at the beginning, kind of explain to them that I find it after a while to be a wee bit offensive to do that, and that did not dissuade them in the slightest. Every single visit was a proselytizing experiment on their part.
And that is where the Christians on speaking religion on the radio come from.
Well, you know, unfortunately, if we were all rather mature, you know, there's a lot of subjects that are interesting to discuss. But as the old saying goes, you know, that's why you don't deserve good things. This is what you do with the good things. You tend to kind of take offense about a whole bunch of things, personalize them, insult the other people with ad hominem attacks. It just goes to hell, if there is a hell. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, there's a lot of topics that I don't mind discussing, but I wouldn't discuss here because people would get the wrong impression, take the wrong tack, and act out, and be angry and upset. I don't want people to be angry and upset. Anyway, Ed, always, always a pleasure to discuss these things with you, and I look forward to future discussions, and thanks to everyone else who went along and participated tonight. It's time 10:26 certainly for a call WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Was that for a call?
Certainly, yes.
Here's a thought. How could hell be any worse than what's going on now with the parts of Ukraine?
Well, to 1 degree, it's temporary. It won't go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever.
That's a cop-out.
I think it's not a cop-out. If you have the choice of being tortured for a day and dying and being tortured for the next 10 trillion years, I think most people will take the former rather than the latter.
I don't recall anyone ever being given that choice.
No, it's my own original one. I'm sure there's loads of of philosophers and such that have extrapolated on the ultimate unfairness of being cast into hell, which actually, again, is primarily not a biblical concept for the most part. It's sort of is a lot of Dante and a lot of Paradise Lost that we've incorporated into the concepts of hell. Okay, very good. We'll blame it on those two guys. They're dead anyway. Anyway, Paul, WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. Very good. Good evening, Ed. Great topic. Riveting. Anyway, WS2N, Paul for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. I just want to start off with this one spacecraft that's going to be re-entering the atmosphere, if it hasn't already today. It's 6,000-pound old-time satellite from years ago. It was launched around 40 years ago and spent 20 years operating. It was called the Earth Radiation Budget Satellite. And it was sent up on Challenger back in 84. And, it studied the atmosphere, had all kinds of detectors, figured out the ozone. That was the one that really started to notice the ozone problem, which we didn't even know we had a problem, which led to the Montreal Protocol, which led to banning our carbon, freons, basically, were causing that problem. So, it died around 20 years ago, but it's taken all these years to come closer and closer to the atmosphere to burn up. And it's supposed to be today, 17 hours one way or the other, and they expect some parts of it to actually make it down to Earth. But, of course, the chances are like 1 in 10,000 that will happen. But it makes you think, with this one particular satellite, there's thousands of satellites up there right now, and thousands more will be going up, and there's more and more of an effort to make sure these things deorbit properly, which is a good thing, but I think gun control is no good. We learned that from China. They had three large boosters that went up in the last year to build their space station, and that final stage, which ran around 20 tons, would eventually deorbit, and thankfully they haven't hit anything. Now their engineers are working on reusability as well, so eventually it all has to go that way. But temporarily, anyway, you could still have stuff coming down and hitting the Earth, although more of a chance of hitting water, being that Earth is covered most by water. We'll see what happens with that particular satellite. I guess I'll see it on tomorrow's website on whether or not that thing came down. That thing was like 15 feet long by 10 feet wide, and pretty heavy, around, like I said, 6,000 pounds. You think it's like a heavy, heavy truck coming down in pieces. But it was at the inclination, roughly, at the International Space Station, although when I went up, the space station didn't exist in 1984. But they were leading up, they wanted to experiment with that inclination anyway, because the earlier flights at that inclination for the shuttle was going to be docking with the Mir spacecraft, which Mir was up there for 15 years. But the last 3 or 4 years, we actually docked with the Russian Mir space station. We had 5 dockings, and of course that eventually led to what we have today, the International Space Station at 51.6 degrees inclination. I guess I should really start off with that. You know, if anybody had any questions or comments, you'd like to go to the next one. Okay, well, anyway, next month there's going to be another crew flight to the International Space Station. They're going to replace four people that are up there flying up on a Dragon spacecraft, on Falcon 9 rocket. They'll be docking with the space station sometime, probably the second week in February, I guess. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is there's going to be four people on board. Two Americans, another guy from the United Arab Emirates, and another fellow from Russia. The three of those four have their ham license. Pilot and the commander, Stephen Bowen, is KI-5BJB with Woody Holberg. He's the pilot. He's got KB-3HTZ. And then the mission specialist is Sultan Al-Nairadi from UAE with KI-5BTV. Notice both of them have the five calls, but Woody has the three calls. Tells me Woody Holberg probably has had his ham license. A lot of these guys, when they train down in Texas, Texas says, you know, hey, you guys ought to get your ham licenses, so you know, be nice to be familiar with the procedures when you're working all the kids on, you know, on Earth, the school contact. And they all wind up with the five call. But I see this one guy with the three call, which I always like to see. My guess is he's probably had his call a while. But I meant to check it. I could probably check that on QRZN. That's always good. Anyway, three out of four. You're going to want more hands on board station starting mid February. Any comments? Okay. Anyway, there's a lander that will be landing on the moon very shortly, in April anyway. I bring that up because had a successful deorbit burn to get it into that location. Went up roughly a month ago, December 11th, from a Falcon rocket from Florida. SpaceX had the contract to launch this particular lander. It's called Hokuto, built by Japan. And Japan was into building this probably for the last 8 or 9 years. They wanted to be part of the Google Prize. Google had a prize at one time, a new lander. Commercial vehicle on the moon, you would get like $20 million or something. And they had a certain date. I think the date ended end of 2017. So if you didn't do it by then, or weren't on the way by then, nobody could get the money, which is what happened. But some of these companies that were involved in this, a private company in Japan, built their Kuzo lander. They didn't care. They were going to build it anyway, build it out. And it turns out this one that's on its way will land in April. They have other ones being built as well. I mean, a lot more. They have planned eight more landing flights for the moon. And hopefully this one makes it. The last two commercial ones that tried to do this over the last couple of years, one was from Israel. Bereshit didn't make it. Had some software problems. And another one from India. That one didn't make it either. Came very close. I think that one got about half a mile off the surface. It's roughly about a kilometer off the surface of the moon. And went haywire on that. And that crashed. That one is being rebuilt. They plan on trying again, as well as the one from Israel. So they would have been the first commercial one to successfully land a vehicle on the moon. It turns out this one might be the one that makes it. It looks like everything's on track to do this too, so. Now, during that launch, Florida, on December 11th, with this vehicle, there was another spacecraft attached to the, you know, as a payload as well, that also headed to the moon. That was a NASA spacecraft, well, flashlight. Flashlight contains a laser beam, infrared operating a laser beam. So once that one gets into orbit, looks like that one's on, you know, scheduled to do that. It'll be in a polar type orbit, and it will use a laser to look inside craters when it gets very close to the surface. They plan on getting around 50 miles above the surface. And depending on the signal that they get back, they can tell how many photons they're sending out compared to what would normally be coming back if it was hitting just the surface. But if it hits ice, it's going to get slightly absorbed, and you're going to get less photons coming back, which will imply that there's ice there, and that's what they want to find. They want to be able to confirm they really believe that it's there, but they, you know, from previous missions, but they would like to really compare and get a better idea of the volume of ice that we're talking about. Permanent, like permafrost inside these craters that never see the light of day on the South Pole. Let's see if flashlight does its job. And that, again, that's a couple of months away before we see any testing done on that and any results coming back to Earth. Any comments? WS2N. Nothing heard. Okay, I haven't talked about the SpaceX Starship lately. But that's still under development. Got a lot of work going on in Texas trying to get the first one off the ground. If he does that, and he predicts that in a couple of months, they'll be able to launch that one. And it won't quite make a whole orbit when it does go up. It's got this heavy booster with 33 engines that are going to fire. If it works, it'll have 17 million pounds of thrust. Give you an idea, the last one that NASA just sent up to the moon is 8.6 million pounds of thrust on that one. This one's got 17 million pounds of thrust if it works. On top of that heavy booster is the Starship itself, and that has seven of these engines, these Raptor engines, same engines that are attached to the booster. One's got 33 and the other one's got seven. And the ultimate goal is that, you know, of course, these things will eventually go into Earth orbit and then eventually lunar orbit and eventually walk to Mars. And right now, of course, he'd be happy to get the booster off the ground. The original plans are to, the actual plans are to bring the booster back to exactly where it took off from. Got these big arms that stick out that are going to grab this thing as it comes down and lands. That's what he's planning. And the spaceship itself eventually come back down and also land where it took off. That's the actual plan. But temporarily, he would like to at least get it off the launch pad with its 33 engines. 33 Raptor engines. Have this thing take off. The booster will, in this case, land in the Gulf of Mexico, because it's going to be leaving from Boca Chica, Texas. Starship itself will go into orbit and not really make one complete orbit around the Earth, but he plans on ditching it in the Pacific near Hawaii. And he'll consider that a success if he does that. And he has other boosters and other Starships being built in Texas, where he could rapidly put another one up in case this one fails, or if it doesn't fail, he'll be able to do his first actual full orbital flight. Now, if Elon Musk does with all of this, hopefully it's successful. Thousands of people working on it. Didn't have one Starship test from Boca Chica in all of 2022. Last one was back in 2021. Seemed to be doing it one right after the other. They were all failing, and finally eventually got one to successfully land. And that was just the Starship itself. That's all seven engines. This one's got both the booster, 33 engines, and the Starship. The seven engines will leave the launch pad hopefully in another month or two. We'll see. It's got a lot of building going on in Florida. The ultimate goal is to not only launch these things in Texas, from Florida as well. You look at Cape Kennedy, they have Launch Complex 39A and Launch Complex 39B. Launch Complex 39B now is where the STS, all the STS will be launched from. SLS, Space Launch System, for NASA to launch the Artemis program. We'll all take off from Launch Complex 39B, 39A. SpaceX has taken that over. That's presently where they launch rockets to the International Space Station, crew vehicles, as well as unmanned flights that they'll launch from there as well. In fact, they have a flight coming up this Thursday from Launch Complex 39A, and that will be three of these Falcon boosters, bumping together. So they call it the Falcon Heavy. Four stage and a port starboard stage. The port starboard will fly back to Landing Zone 1, which used to be called Launch Complex 13 years ago, where he's got two landing pads there, big concrete circles. And the core stage will be expendable. That will wind up in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. So he's launching a mission for Space Force, for the government, to geosynchronous orbit. That's the story on that. But the Southern Launch Complex building is only around 1,000 meters or so from the existing 39A launch site building. This other launch complex, which will eventually launch the Starship and the Starship Heavy from Florida. And he's coming a long way. I've seen pictures. He's got this whole massive tower built, 450-foot tower, almost completely built. He's got these big arms that were fabricated in Florida. He just moved over to the site. Eventually, that's going to be installed onto the tower. His arms ride up and down on rails, it's on to two things. One of the things is when they set up a booster, his arms will pick up that booster and set it onto the pad where it's going to be launched from, and then eventually grabs the Starship, and takes that and puts that on top of the booster. That's one of the purposes of these big arms that he's got sticking out of the tower. But his main purpose is to catch the booster when it comes back. Plans on reusing all this stuff. So you can imagine a booster going up, pushing the Starship into orbit, and have the booster with nitrogen jets turn around and reignite its engines and fly all the way back to Cape Kennedy. And then through the atmosphere, kind of like the space shuttle. You know, it's gonna do a belly flop as it slides through. A little bit aerodynamic, which will eventually slow itself down. But as it gets toward the launch complex that it took off from, it plans on firing little rocket jets, going vertical, and then slowing itself down right where it took off from. And as it comes down, these big arms are going to come out and grab it, and then the arms are going to slowly put it back down on the launch pad that it took off from. I don't know. This sounds pretty far-fetched. I give this, like, you know, a 1 in 100 chance of working the first two or three times. I think there's going to be a lot of fiery explosions, a lot of problems until he gets this right, similar to what he had with the early flights of the Falcon 9. They wanted to land him on the deck of these ships. That one failure after the other. They either missed the boat entirely or hit the boat and wind up exploding on the ship until eventually he got it right. Now he's very successful at it. He's got now over 100 successful propulsive landings with his Falcon 9 boots. So hopefully he'll get it right. And, you know, you say 33 engines fighting all at one time. Oh, that's terrible. How's he going to do that? You know, that's a long way from, you know, the Falcon 9. But, he's launched four Falcon 9 Heavy so far. Falcon 9 Heavy is essentially 27 engines that he's launching at the same time for the Falcon Heavy. So it's only half a dozen more engines. The only difference is the engines he uses for the Falcon 9, they're called Merlin engines, and they run roughly 250,000 pounds of thrust. These new RAPs are almost, around 530,000 pounds of thrust each. So roughly double the thrust on each engine. And it's 33 instead of 27. Any comments or questions? This is WS.
WB2BXO.
Okay, coming in on EchoLink. I heard the code for that. When you want T, we hear DL. How you doing, Frank? Back to you.
Yeah, very good. Just wanted to make sure you were copying me before I started talking. I think another difference between the Falcon Heavy and the Super Heavy is I think Musk decided a while back, or maybe his engineers did, but anyway, they have decided not to make the Super Heavy a crew rate, not to make the Falcon Heavy a crew-rated launch vehicle. They could only launch satellites and probes on that one. And, of course, they're increasing level of difficulty by making the Super Heavy, what some people call the BFR, crew-rated, which is, I understand, is the difference. We have to have a lot more redundant systems in order to match the requirements for carrying the crew. And maybe you're going to get to it. I think Spaceport Cornwall, I think, is supposed to be doing its first launch, I think, tomorrow. Virgin Orbit launch. So go ahead.
Okay. And, Virgin Orbital has been off from Virgin Galactic, Branson. He has the rocket. It's called the Launcher 1, which I'm sure you know. And that attaches to the body of a 747, the port wing. Now, I believe it's three, he calls them Newton engines, that he uses. And he's been successful on a couple of flights so far with Launcher 1. So now, yeah, this would be the first flight out of, officially out of the UK. he's got a, it's actually going to leave from Ireland. It's called the facility he uses to fly out of. But, you know, that'll put England on the map as being able to find something in space. So that's pretty good. And, okay, with the human rating, rating of, you know, launch vehicles. Yeah, you're right, the Falcon Heavy, which is three Falcons bolted together, was initially planned to be human-rated, that was the plan, but he changed that over time. Originally, it was the first Heavy was supposed to launch 2013, and the years ticked by, he finally got it up in 2017, you know, 4 or 5 years later, but yeah, he made it. Make these predictions. A lot of things in rocketry, you know, a lot of people make predictions, but they wind up late. The only one that winds up pretty much on time, it's a little late, was Peter Beck with Electron Rocket, flying out of New Zealand. He's got the North Island of New Zealand. He's got two launch complexes there. And now he's got a third in Virginia, Wallops Island, which was supposed to go up right around Christmas time, but they had some heavy winds, you know, the cold weather that we had, and the winds was delayed, so that had to probably go up. But he wasn't too far off of his prediction. He's still trying to recover his, the boost, trying to catch him with the helicopter. Came close twice so far, but no good yet. Anyway, back to you, Frank, WS.
Yeah, that's, Peter Beck's program is interesting. Originally, it was a New Zealand company, and then he did some operations to make it a U.S. company so he'd be allowed to launch U.S. national security payloads, and apparently... At first, the excuse was tax purposes, but I think it was kind of obvious all along that there was something else going on, because I don't think any foreign companies incorporate in the United States to save taxes. Anyway, but ultimately it turned out, I think, that he wanted to launch the U.S. national security payloads, and the only way to do that was to be a U.S. company and also to have a U.S. base. So I think that's the story with him launching from here. But yeah, that helicopter thing is very interesting. I think what was it? One of the YouTubers did some very nice interviews with him. Go ahead.
I didn't see that interview yet. Yeah. And then he was actually supposed to launch from Wallops Island actually about 2 years ago. But he's been put off the FCC, not FCC, the FAA does not want him to launch until he had proper FTS system, flight termination system, FTS they call it. Flight termination system is essentially you launch a rocket. If something goes wrong, they've got explosives in all these rockets, and in the not too distant past, every rocket that was launched was being tracked by radar. And, you know, let's say from Florida, you know, they were launched. They have these radars looking at the vehicle, and if they wandered away, they were going off course. You know, not necessarily spinning out of control, but it's just going off course. Guy, looking at the radar, would see this, and somebody would be responsible for transmitting a signal to blow the rocket up so it doesn't come down in an unpopulated area. On Electronics SpaceX really led the way with this. The flight termination system inside the vehicle, they have gyroscopes and everything in the vehicle, And the vehicle itself knows it's going off course. And if it sees itself going off course, it will detonate. We'll abort the mission by blowing the whole vehicle. And they needed that clearance certification from the government. The electron rocket that's being launched from
NASA. Complete.
Needed to prove out that the FTS system would work, which they've done, so that's why they got the okay to launch. We'll see how it goes. SpaceX, it works so good. Without that, you wouldn't be able to even have the Falcon Heavy 2 boosters come back and land in Florida. As would be, would be full. You wouldn't be able to know which one was which. But that type of system, each booster that's going up on Falcon 9, drop it in the port, know if it's going off course. So that allows them to both come back and land at the same time. And I know you've seen it, Frank, but if you've seen the landings of these two vehicles coming down and landing in a launch complex, landing zone, one they call it. They come down and land. Flying down with a center rocket, under a propulsive landing. The last few seconds, you see the four legs open up, and they land exactly at the same time. It's fascinating. Any other comments, Frank, or anybody else? This is WS. Okay, and it's getting late. Anyway, next month or so, it is going to be a comet that we'll have to be looking for. They say you with binoculars, or maybe it was even by eye, people will be able to see it. And they say it's going to be nearest Earth in the beginning of February 1st. So you'd be able to go out and look at this comet. I wrote it down here somewhere. What do you call this? Comet C-2022. And that's the year that it was first founded. And it first founded, actually, out near Jupiter. Now it's already gone around the sun, and now it's heading back in the direction of Earth. And eventually it's going to be passing nearby Mars as well. Should be interesting. Anyway, I'm sure that will make the news a couple of weeks from now. Any comments? If not, we're going to close down. I think it's getting a little after 11. Any other last comments? This is WS. Okay, nothing good. Nothing heard. And we'll turn it back to you, Roy. This has been WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And tomorrow's Monday, so that would be the Club InfoNet, which comes on at 8:30 and is repeated. And then that's always followed by Swap and Chop, and followed by Newsline after that. Monday night is pretty good for the repeater. I'll turn it over to you, Roy, ACTGS. This has been WS2N. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net. Thank you for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I appreciated that as well. I hope everyone had a little fun, learned a few things, taught other people a few things. It's all part of the package. So wish everyone a happy, healthy week. And please come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. I'll remind you, Dick KQRIW ended most of his technical meds, which he suggests to be kind to each other. It's always a good idea, especially now. Still got COVID, so that's other problems. So be kind to each other. Don't take things too personal. Don't be upset with stuff. Just try and be helpful. And once again, want to just throw out, I want to throw out Hamlin's razor, because it's a great adage that I really love. It says, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. I think a lot of the evil in the world, unfortunately, is not due to inherent evil, but incompetent stupidity. And always like to add, Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. Keep your mind open, and you'll learn new interesting things. It's a fun thing to do. Once again, thanks everyone. Be well. Come back next Sunday when we'll try and do this all over again. So I formally now close this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and AC2GS is clear.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
FlyMarkInfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2